Drink order at Hot Docs. I'd like to thank you all for coming and welcome to Hot Docs Talks First Person. It's the second in our three-part series of filmmaker discussions. Just before we get started, I want to thank our sponsor, the Canadian Television Fund. As well, please note that the Creative Communications Department at Centennial College is taping this for a podcast. So if you've, have friends or family that missed it or you want to listen to it again, just visit the Centennial College website, and you can navigate to the Hot Docs talk. So with that, I'm very pleased to introduce our moderator of this afternoon's panel, Jeff Prevere, a movie critic for the Toronto Star.
Thank you, and thank you very much for coming. It may simply be coincidence, it may not, but today is Michael Moore's 53rd birthday. And I have a feeling that his name might come up a couple of times over the next hour and a half. what we're going to be discussing today is the phenomenon of what we're calling the first-person documentary form. And what we mean by that, in a very general sense, are films in which the filmmakers figure prominently, not just as the creators of the films, but as participants within the film. And in most cases, and certainly in all cases with our panel today, as presences on camera. The first-person form of documentary filmmaking is something that has a tradition in documentary filmmaking. I mean, it didn't begin with Michael Moore and Roger and me. Prior to Michael Moore, you had people like Claude Lanzmann and Marcelo Fools who were working in the first-person form in France. Nick Broomfield in England has been doing it for years. Michael Rubo in Canada for the National Film Board. And of course, Ross McKelvey in the United States has been doing it for a long time. But with the incredible sort of blockbusting nonfiction filmmaking of Michael Moore, we have definitely seen more first-person films. What we're going to talk about today are the specific reasons why each of these filmmakers chose to make films, if they did indeed choose to make films in the first-person form, what the implications of the first-person form is for documentary practice, because it is one of the biggest developments of the last 15 to 20 years in documentary. And then we will turn it over to you so that any questions, any comments that you might have about first-person documentary, any comments to our filmmakers, will then be heartily engaged. Correct? Yes. Okay, so I'm going to start at the end, and I'll introduce everybody, and then I'll go back again. Brian Friedman is the director of a film which is called The Bodybuilder and I, which is about his relationship with his father, who just happens to be a rather obsessive bodybuilder, and a figure about whom in the film we learn that Brian has ambivalent feelings about. Debbie Melnick is the co-director with Rick Kane of Manufacturing Dissent, which is a film about Michael Moore, but it is also about the filmmaking practice of Michael Moore. And it is also, in its way, a film that kind of, Debbie will tell us a little bit about this, certainly not by its original intent, kind of mirrors or echoes the basic narrative through line of Roger and Me, although it discovers that perhaps that wasn't the original narrative through line of Roger and Me as well. Sitting next to Debbie is Alan Zweig. Alan will be familiar to anyone who has been attending Hot Docs over the years. He is the director of Vinyl and I, Curmudgeon, and his new film is called Lovable. Alan has worked in these three films in something that we definitely recognize as the first-person form, but who practices it in a very, I think, distinctive way, is very different from the way that we have probably would think of first-person documentaries, and hopefully he'll tell us a little bit about his own first-person practice. Jamie Kastner is sitting here to my immediate right. He is the director of Kike Like Me, which is a film that is about, on one hand, it's about the experience of being Jewish, or maybe being Jewish, or possibly being Jewish, in the 21st century. Really, it's about the whole phenomenon of identity politics and what it means to be identified with something and what happens when you can't be pinned down to that identity in a world where identity politics has become such an important mode of political and cultural discourse. So I'm going to open the panel.
Jeff, can I just interject?
Sure.
I'm not as good at this as my parents were, but I think you could, except for you, I think you could call the whole panel kikes like us.
Okay. We'll retitle it then. Kikes like us, except me. Except me. So I'm going to begin with a question actually that was articulated to me by Mr. Zweig in an interview I did with him the other day, which is the question that he said that it is important to ask yourself before you work in the first person form in documentary, which is, how does it benefit my film that I am in it? So, Brian, if you could tell me a little bit about your decision to appear in your film, why you are there, and why you thought that was important.
The film was started as a film about a geriatric bodybuilding competition, which I thought was kind of a really quirky, sort of odd endeavor for guys between the ages of 50 and 60, most of whom have come into bodybuilding relatively late in life, and I just thought it was a really odd phenomenon. And having gone to one of the shows before, I just thought there was a film in it. But one of the top competitors happened to be my father, and I couldn't ignore that he was one of the top competitors, and I couldn't ignore that he was my father. And I also couldn't ignore the feelings that I had about him. So to not include myself in the film felt like it would be completely dishonest. So I didn't really have a choice in the matter. It felt to me, if I were going to make a film about geriatric bodybuilding, it would also have to be a film about fathers and sons. And I think in the end, it probably ends up being more about fathers and sons than about bodybuilding. But I think it kind of happened organically.
So there was, at the beginning though, when you were thinking about doing the film on geriatric bodybuilding, you were thinking more of perhaps something like Pumping Iron, were you?
Yeah, I mean, I love Pumping Iron. I thought it was a great movie. And I was thinking like a nice little entertaining 42-minute documentary, maybe would be on the lens or something. And that's what I was really thinking about. And my producer, Julia, who liked the idea of the bodybuilding film, but really thought that what was more interesting was the way I talked about my father when I talked about it. And she thought that was really kind of engaging. And so she urged me to explore that a little bit. And once it started, it just didn't stop.
You have a clip for us. Tell us about it.
I hope it's the right clip. I think this is, my father is tanning. So there's a whole series of things that old bodybuilders need to do, one of which is tanning. So this is me going to watch him tan.
You're not going to be able to come in here if the door's closed and the camera,
sure.
Right? In this small area?
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
Or whatever.
Sort of looks like you're a character in Star Trek.
Oh, whatever.
Watching my father bake under 6,000 watts of ultraviolet light is kind of amusing. But there's something irritating about it too. I mean, here's a guy who can spend so much time and energy on a bizarre hobby, but who could never spend any time and energy on a relationship with his own son. I'm an adult, and I know I should be over these feelings by now. But in moments like these, that old resentment starts rising to the surface. What was he doing while I was growing up?
Okay, that's a clip from Brian Friedman's The Bodybuilder and I. I get a sense of just exactly how personal the framing is and how crucial that first-person voice is to the narrative that the story tells. Debbie's story of the pursuit of Michael Moore and manufacturing dissent is a story I know a little bit about, but I'm going to let her tell it. How did, I know that you were had no plans to originally be on camera, but you are. How'd that happen?
Well, we thought that, you know, Michael would eventually do an interview and that we would use that interview to be the narrative voice over the film. And although we'd interview his friends and foe and, you know, different people, we thought that basically we'd use his voice for the film. But then when we weren't getting any response to any of our requests for an interview, and the other thing is that when we started to call people for interviews about Michael, we'd get very strange responses, which we weren't filming. People would hang up on us, or they'd say, oh yes, and they'd tell us all this stuff about, you know, what it was like working with Michael, and then they would cancel the interview with us the day of the interview, and we didn't have any of the stuff on film, so we just kind of thought, God, well, a lot of this stuff is being left on the cutting room floor, and what are we going to do? And, you know, maybe we should just start filming everything, including our attempts to get the interview with Michael and also the people we were trying to do interviews with. So, yeah, it ended up with a bit of a different film than we originally thought.
We're going to look at a clip now from Manufacturing Dissent. What have you selected?
This is actually it's near the end, and when Michael gives me a few minutes of his time, and I know I told you this on the phone, but I know I don't really like going up to people and saying, oh, you know, give me an interview and all that. So it's sort of like my bumbling Columbo attempt to talk to Michael more at the end. And of course, I don't have all the facts in front of me, which I should have had, or all the information. And so this, you'll see what happens.
This is your Manufacturing Dissent.
So I still can't convince you to do the interview or anything.
The Canadians are so...
No. We're persistent. We're very persistent. We can't, I mean, can I...
What do you want now?
I said we can't convince you maybe to do a sit-down interview at some point. Email you.
Not now, not while I'm working. But, you know, I'll be done with this film. And then, you know, maybe we could do something. But that would be... I'm a year away from that.
Still a year away.
Yeah.
I asked Michael about the allegation that he owned Halliburton stock.
Have you seen the back cover of this book you're talking about?
Well, that's what I'm talking
about. It doesn't say anything about a foundation. It makes it look like it's my tax return.
Oh, okay.
It's photoshopped. Yeah. Look at the book.
Oh, it's photoshopped.
You don't see anything about any foundation.
Oh, there's no foundation.
You don't see anything about a foundation. Make it look like it's my tax return.
But your foundation didn't do it either, right?
I do not. No. First of all, which foundation are you talking about? Because I'm on the board of directors of a number of charities.
Your personal charity.
I don't have a personal foundation.
Okay.
So there's another thing that's wrong.
Michael is the president of a private foundation called the Center for Alternative Media and Culture. And according to a 2000 tax return, which can easily be found on the Foundation Center's website, they sold a number of stocks, including the pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly, Halliburton, and the defense contractor Honeywell.
Why? I've got more important things to do than to answer crazy right-wingers. The time is short. The people know the truth. You can't fool the people. Little while, yes. Long term, no. And nobody will believe that stuff. And they don't believe it. Between all the stuff we've talked about tonight, you got a good 20 minutes.
Okay.
All right?
Just as I walk away, Michael grabs me for a hug.
Canadian hug.
Being Canadian, we don't hug at the drop of a hat. I feel awkward, and I also realize how manipulative it is. But I grin like an unabashed fan anyway.
But you still look like you can't wait to get away.
Yeah, I couldn't. It was a very awkward moment.
I mean, what's interesting is, of course, that he becomes, in your film, what the Roger Smith character was to Michael Moore in Roger and Me.
So 10 years from now, we're going to find that you really did get an interview with Michael Moore.
Yeah, exactly. That, in fact, you
but
had.
I'll do the interview. You can do it, Jamie. Follow me.
Alan Zweig is the director of Lovable. And Lovable features a number of interviews with women who are largely talking about the experience of relationships in their lives. Many of them are single. Many of them have chosen to be that way. Some of them have not chosen to be that way. And interspersed with these interviews are Alan's own observations about the role of love and relationships and women in his life. And in a way, what the film does is that the points of conversation, the points of concern insecurity in some cases on Alan's part become the subjects, not Alan, but the subjects that are then explored in conversations in the film itself. Alan, how did you choose to adopt this particular form? Because it's the third film now in which you do this.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's people that would say my films are all about me, even if two-thirds of the film I'm not in, and I've heard that, but I just don't think of it that way. When I made the first one, Vinyl, I'd never made a documentary, and I was coming from drama background, and when I made drama, I was always looking for a subplot or side characters. I was always looking for something to cut away to, basically, you know, just go away from the main story, come back to the main story. So I tried to find a way to put myself, to be able to tell my story about record collecting in this record collecting movie, thinking maybe it would be a structuring device. I have to say, though, that like all the time through editing, I kept saying to my friends and my editor, I'm not really going to do this, am I? And they were like, no, this is the best part of the film. And so it ended up being structured that way. I ended up shooting into a mirror partly because, you know, like I saw Brian's film yesterday, and there are just shots where he's standing there. I would die before I would have a shot like that in my film. I just couldn't stand. I mean, it's a very simple thing. Good for him for not having the horrible self-image that I have, but I could not do that. I would have to cut that out. I have to be in the editing room looking at myself. So basically, I have, we'll say, made my peace with how I look in the mirror, because I do look in the mirror, but I don't usually stand back and watch myself standing there, and I couldn't stand to look at that. So, and also, just to be honest, it's very comfortable for me to be behind the camera. And so that's what the mirror afforded me. Any other metaphoric qualities it may have is just something I will take credit for, but I don't deserve. And that's pretty well it. So after I made Vinyl, and it was, you know, with very little competition, the most successful thing I'd done and most recognition I'd ever got, I thought, well, I think I've discovered some kind of template here where I could explore other ideas, like people have been calling me negative all my life. I think they've been calling you negative. What do you feel about that? Or, you know, this film is sort of like, I'm single. There are many things in my life that I'm not going to get that I once wanted that I can make my peace with. I know you're supposed to let go of attachment, but I can't let go of this one. And so I just went to other people and said, are you all right with that? So that's what it's about, is the last one I'm doing with myself in it, because frankly, I'm tired of the, you know, I'm not Paris friggin' Hilton, like, and people, when you put yourself in your film, they just completely forget that you're a filmmaker, you know? They, you know, I mean, even Jeff wrote a nice review, but, you know, he said something like rumpled and craggy voiced, and I'm like, am I Jack Klugman, you know, like...
I had Paris Hilton-esque, but they took it out.
Anyway, I am tired. When you put yourself in your film, people forget that you're a filmmaker, and it's kind of annoying. Even though, I mean, I have nothing to complain about. I've gotten great appreciation of the films. But anyway, I decided to do a trilogy after Vinyl, and this is the end of the trilogy, and you won't have my face to kick around anymore.
So it's Adios First Person for Alan Zweig. Kike, like me, could have been... Oh, no, you do get a clip. I'm sorry. No.
I talk so much. I wanted to do one of those. Oh, they brought a clip?
No, okay. No.
But
let's look at a clip from Lovable. Alan, first of all, what are we going to look at?
Oh, I picked this for you because it has nothing to do really with being single. It's more because the film is sort of the mirror image to my first film, Vinyl, I thought I'd put some stuff about music in it. For about the last year and a half, I've planned that when I got it together to get a newer, faster computer, I would start converting most, if not all, my CDs to MP3s and keep them on my hard drive, and for the most part, play them on my hard drive. I got my new computer and I've begun, finally, the MP3 project. What I'm doing now is cleaning up for 10 years of record and CD accumulation. Sort of like getting rid of the evidence. You know, some woman, maybe she heard that I have a lot of records. She's kind of has misgivings. Didn't he once have thousands of records? Yes, but did he get rid of them? No, not exactly. He sucked them all down. He boiled them all down. And she'd be like, oh, that's pretty impressive. It's like, yeah. Well, I was getting ready for you, babe.
Has it worked?
No.
No?
No.
The film hasn't aired yet. I mean, you know.
Absolutely. A clip from Lovable, Alan Zweig's film. Jamie Castner's film is called Kike Like Me. In this film, I could imagine that, I mean, you might not have used the word kike, I'm not sure, but I could imagine that you could have made a film on this subject that you were not in. Was that ever a possibility, and how come you're in it?
Well, this is the third film that I've done that I'm in, and so I've been trying to, you know, develop this mode of working, although my background was directing stuff that I wasn't in previously. And actually, I came into it because in my first film, which was shot by a friend who is not a professional cameraman, we went and shot at the Quebec City Anti-Global Summit and came home after the week of shooting and put it in, and I saw that he shot everything in a two-shot. There were no close-ups in the entire film, so I was in everything. I mean, I knew I was going to be in it, but I thought, okay, I'll be there, ask a question, and then I'll go in. So after cursing him for a long while, I realized that something, you know, funny, you know, a little bit like Alan was saying about a style having developed to a certain extent by accident, something worked. And again, as actually, there's part of Debbie's film where she talks about how Michael Moore first discovered, you know, something, a different quality came up, and you mentioned in your article, different quality comes up when there's some interplay between the interviewer and the subject. I found that this gave a different texture to the material. So anyway, that's when I began exploring this kind of style. Then when I was raising money, which as we all know is a long and arduous process, for my next film, which was about an even more, you know, personally remote subject, it was about gypsy jazz guitar fans, that I also kind of half put myself in and then had to reconcile it in the edit suite and didn't quite, you know, have a clear decision. I was thinking, God, this is a long and arduous process. I should choose a subject that I actually really personally give a shit about to, you know, put all this work into. Actually, I did wind up liking and caring about that film eventually, but not in the fundraising stage. Anyway, so this was born of, yes, this was something, you know, it is people ask me if I'm Jewish. And that's the opening line for the personal part of the journey. And I felt that if nothing else, I could, and there have been many films done on this subject, and I think the question would be, why do another film on this subject that didn't have some kind of unique angle on it? And you think about the topic, it's so vast. I'm not the person to do the definitive anything, probably, right, but certainly not on this topic. Right. And I wasn't interested in doing anything encyclopedic, so what you're left with is kind of a personal, I think another way of describing this style of film could be, you know, the essay film, which also doesn't necessarily imply that you have to be in it, but, you know, for the sake of possibly more illuminating material and entertainment value, I decided to be in it. Mm-hmm. And actually what happened was, because I actually see that I'm working in a kind of, it's kind of a faux personal journey. You know, it's not like a real revelation, let's say, like Brian's, a real exploration, or at least that's not what I set out to do.
But as you've seen the film, it gets pretty personal by the end, no matter how kind of aloof and wisecracking I try to remain. And even though I wasn't necessarily happy about it, and it's not necessarily pleasant to watch, as a director, I recognize the strength of the material in that latter part. And like all documentaries, I think you have to follow your material.
Right, right. And that strength wouldn't have been there if you hadn't been there.
I don't think so. No, you know, I mean, how many that section I'm thinking of happens in Germany and Auschwitz. I mean, how many bloody times have we seen that subject covered in films? And, then usually there's like a Yahrzeit candle lit at the end of it, and then we go to the quote-unquote happy ending in Israel, as though such a thing, as though a happy ending to the Holocaust could ever be possible. Anyway, yeah, so I was not interested in doing something that had been done before. I mean,
tell us about the clip we're going to look at.
Okay, so I chose a clip in which, I don't know if this will all work out. What I was hoping is that we might look at maybe the beginning and the end of a section in which I go to interview Pat Buchanan, the three-time presidential candidate, you know, poobah of the far right. And ultimately, he kicks me out at the end. And I chose this because it's one, I think, it shows some of the stuff you can get with this kind of first personal filmmaking that you wouldn't get otherwise. You know, shooting the drive up, the knock on the door, et cetera, et cetera. Well, okay, you'll watch the clip. I don't have to describe it. And now the clip.
The Israelis.
I'm just going to read a paragraph that's sort of apropos. I think you're even referring to some of it. And while many neocons are Jewish, most Jewish writers and intellectuals in America are liberals, and many are among the sharper critics of neoconservatism. Even on the right, not all Jewish writers are neocon, though support for Israel is broad and deep, and no more surprising than is opposition to abortion among Catholics, Mormons, and evangelical Christians. Mm-hmm. So let's just talk about the latter part of that, that the support for Israel seems to, I think what you're saying there is that the support for Israel is uniform among Jews on the right and the left?
My view is quite simply that Americans, we have a national interest which is American alone, and it cannot be defined by our allegiances and loyalties or concerns for countries around the world where our ancestors may have come from.
But they have
everything. So you're looking for answers that you're not getting.
No, I'm trying to understand this quite complex paragraph of your book.
I don't think it's very complex at all.
Well, it seems to suggest to me that you're saying that you know, it's a disproportionate number of Jews who are
You read the paragraph, I think it stands.
Okay.
All right? Why don't we call it a day?
Okay.
All right?
All right. Mm-hmm. It's a day.
Okay.
Could have rolled one more second when he signs my book, but anyway. Actually, yeah, I'd hoped to show the first. It was too complicated. But anyway, you know, seeing the drive up there and, you know, the grand mini White House that he lives in, and meeting his wife and his housekeeper, and him going to put powder on, all on camera. You know, I show up rolling. And also that painting that's standing behind him, there's a little bit with that early on that I'm reading it. We're filming in the room before he arrives, and I read the caption, which is Pat Buchanan, Pitbull of the Far Right on the Prowl. And then during the interview, he's giving me a tour, and I ask him to read the caption. He's forgotten what it is, and he's like, oh, what was it again? And he starts reading Pitbull of the Far Right. And without missing a beat, he goes down to a clock. This is a clock President Nixon gave me on. And it's something very revealing about how slick he is. I think that particularly with celebrities, they've become so savvy with dealing with the media. You know, even in this clip, you can see it's like textbook media handling. Answer the question that you wish you were asked rather than the one you actually were asked. So I think that putting this kind of showing the stuff in the margins, if you will, you know, our journey up there, the little bit of banter, the fumbling, you know, I suppose in strict kind of interview dueling sense, he won that round. Mm-hmm. But in a different sense, like with Debbie's clip, actually, the very force of the man compared to your timid little Canadian interviewer shows you is very revealing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What I'd like to do now is just kind of open it up to anyone's feedback or comments. But Brian, I guess I'll start with you, and I'd like to ask, it seems to me that we are seeing more first-person documentaries now than ever before. Would you care to speculate on why that's happening, and do you think there are shortcomings to using this kind of documentary form?
I'm not so sure we're seeing more of them. I just think that more of them are being exposed. I think, Ross McElwee, you mentioned him earlier, was a huge influence on me. And I was always familiar with the Nick Broomfields and the Ross McElwees when I was going to school and learning about this stuff. And those were always the films that impacted on me the most. And sort of certainly with Fahrenheit 9/11 and Bowling for Columbine and Morgan Spurlock, it kind of reached a larger audience. But I'm not wholly convinced that there's more of them being made, just more people going to see them. So I don't really know how to answer that first question. But as far as whether there are limitations, I think the answer is yes, but I hesitate to look at the entire genre in a box and sort of say first-person documentaries shouldn't be made or should be made. I think there are good first-person documentaries, and I think there are bad first-person documentaries, just like any other genre of film. And so I think when you're looking at films like this, it's really important, for me anyways, to look at the film as a film in the context of what it's trying to accomplish, mm-hmm. as opposed to maybe discounting it because, oh, it's a first person, another woe is me, or another, look how smart I am, or another I'm going to tell you what the world is about. So I think, for me, it's always been about, let's look at the film as a film, and what's it saying, and can I relate to it? Mm-hmm. And if the first person form works for that film, all the power to you, I think.
Did you ever have moments where you asked yourself the question? I don't mean the question to sound cold, because I'm sure, but during the moments when you're creating and putting it together, you probably ask yourself questions like this, which is a question like, "Who cares about how I feel about my dad?"
Every single second of making the film. I mean, like, don't get me wrong. I'm a private person. It's not this to me wasn't an enjoyable endeavor. It's a very painful process. It's not something I liked doing. It was something I needed to do. And for whatever reason, this sort of film is the way I feel like I can express myself the best. So for me, making the film was essential. And then as far as putting it in the theaters, I don't need people to see the film. I really don't. I mean, I'm happy if people respond well to it and people seem to enjoy it. And if they laugh at the funny bits, it's a relief. But it's like, I don't think any of us up here are looking for stardom. We're not looking for like adulation. We're just looking to deal with something that maybe,
except for Alan.
I think Alan might take a bit, just a handful.
Well, no, it's nice. One good thing about your film, if people like your film, is that they know you made it. People come up to me and say, "I saw your film," which they wouldn't if I hadn't been in it. So I've had some pleasant things. But let me just answer your first question. Yes, there are more. There's no question. It's not even a question. There are way more. And you could do a festival of films with people and their parents. There's a lot of films about people with their parents. And there's a lot of great ones. I don't know. I just recommend anybody who hasn't seen it.
I think 51 this is that festival.
Really? No, I don't think so. If you haven't seen 51 Birch Street, that's a fantastic film. That totally, I'm glad the guy didn't feel the taboo when he made that film. But you know what there is more of, what I find there's more of, is more people being narrators in their films and not in them on camera, but even being narrating it, feeling no compunction against coming on at the beginning and saying, "Hi, I'm Joe Smith, this is my film. This is what my film is about. This is why I'm making my film," which I was talking before. It sort of reminds me of like grade 10 essay disease. Like, in my essay, I will prove. And then at the end, you say, "Thus, in my essay, I have proved," So there's just way more of that. Or even this thing, a very well-known film, I won't mention it. And there's, at a certain point, you see like India or something like this. And he says, kind of like, "My journey took me next to India." And I'm thinking, okay, if you're going to be honest, just say, I went to India to get India in my film. You know, it wasn't a journey that there just happened to be a camera on. So this whole, so people being in their films, yes, there's more of that because the floodgates have opened, but that bothers me less personally than people being in their film too much when they're in their film. And there's definitely a lot of that, and it's like I said in your article, when I started, there was like a panel of judging, finger-wagging documentary filmmakers who would have no compunction to tell you, you shouldn't have even left your off-camera question in there. You should not, like it was, and you know, that was bullshit. But I do sometimes wish that people felt that taboo as I still feel it, even though I'm breaking it.
Yeah, it's a little bit like in newspapers, everybody is a columnist now. I mean, I remember when I started working in newspapers a dozen years ago, like it was only people who had, you know, earned it. They had been war correspondents or they had some kind of particular qualification. Now everybody who's gone for a bikini wax gets a column. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that does sort of open the floodgates to a lot of crap. But then there was, I mean, when you talk about that boring structure, you know, there are plenty of documentaries with that kind of, what you describe as the grade 10 essay structure that were made without, you know, without people, the personal narrator, you know, made with the voice of God narrator, and they continue to be made. So there's, mm-hmm. you know, there's good stuff and there's crap in any form.
Yeah, somehow, I don't know, just like I'm writing fiction again and, you know, there's a whole thing about expository dialogue and how much you try not to say, just show, and it just, maybe it's just style, but like for me, when the person comes on and says why they're making the film when it's patently obvious to me why they're making the film, mm-hmm. it's not a big deal, it doesn't blow, but it takes me out of the film. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. There are things that just like, now I'm not watching your film. I'm watching every film where I've ever heard somebody say that. And that's, you know, I mean, it doesn't ruin films, but I really do wish I could go into all their editing rooms and kind of say, you didn't have to say that.
Well, it's certainly for, as a viewer, for me, it sets up a different relationship with the film. Because suddenly I have, it's just a small one, but there's a little chip on my shoulder which says, I hope you're going to prove to me why you're here. And I think that maybe that's because I also remember that era. And of course, there was the insane sort of, not insane because it produced some great films, but the most kind of radical example of this kind of documentary chastity, I guess, was probably Cinema Verite, right? You know, which was based on the conceit that the filmmaker couldn't even really be seen, which of course is another fallacy. But Debbie, you were saying when we were speaking the other day that, you know, this is the first film that you've made, that you have been in, that you only reluctantly appeared in it only because that's what the film became. So would you tell me a little bit about why you prefer to make documentary films in which you are not a presence on screen?
I don't actually like going up to people and saying, oh, you know, can I do this or can I do that? And just that whole, I guess, drama, I get very nervous around doing that. I really love doing interviews with people because my background is journalism, so I love talking to people and just sitting down and interviewing people. And you know, I usually have like these two-hour interviews that I, but just following people around with the camera, I'm just not that comfortable with. And it's funny, this one in particular, because, you know, I don't, you were saying, Alan, that people come up and go, oh, it's your film. I, you know, instead, especially I guess with something like this, which is very bizarre for me with the manufacturing descent, you know, I'm getting people calling out of the blue, I don't even know, saying, are you that person who did this or stopping on the street? And I find that a bit frightening, you know, to tell you the truth, and strange. And, you know, but I did find that, what was the question? I don't know, I'm just blathering on.
Why you would actually ideally prefer to make films that you're not in? I mean, the first, like this is a film that basically, you're dragged into it.
I like I love the Frank film. I just like telling a story, you know, using verites, actually, you know, just people in the scenes talking about what they're doing, like with the Frank Truth film, you know, having the people sort of tell the story who are in the film. It's hard, you know, it's actually harder to do that than if you put yourself in the film, I think. It's easier because you can bridge over a lot of things with narration, which you can't do if you just film everything and try to put the different scenes together. But I don't know.
You're saying it's harder to do it when you're not in it?
Yeah.
I would think the opposite, really? Actually. I think, in this mode, when you're in it, I think you've got a much greater freedom if you're not in it. You know, I mean, we all know in editing you can move everything around any which way you want. I found in this one, for instance, you've got actually emotional stuff happening, then you've got to make your voiceover correspond to what was actually happening, even if it wasn't the best thought out, you know, spiel that you could possibly give. There it is on camera, and it's around some other good material, and you're stuck with it.
Right.
Yeah, no, I disagree. I think it doesn't make it easier to make a good film, but it does make it easier to make a film. There's no doubt. And that's, I think, actually why I haven't taken statistics.
Who are you disagreeing with? What?
I'm disagreeing with you that you say it's harder to be in your film.
Oh, kikes like us. Sure.
You know, for 2 years, I was thinking about making this film called Sorta Jewish. And
I suppose I owe you.
So you stole
our lawyers can meet at Bagel World, all right?
So anyway, no, I think there's a reason, in fact, why a lot of first films are films that people are in, because it makes it easier if you can point to something and say what's happening there. And as soon as you put yourself in the film, it gives you an opportunity to narrate, and it gives you an opportunity to highlight things, which, you know, is sometimes in your film, when you can't highlight it, you really wish you could. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a thing, let the audience figure it out. I don't like letting the audience figure it out. Really, I don't.
Well, there's narration without being in the film. I mean,
right, I guess. But I'm including you narrating your film or you being in your film.
Any narrator, I mean, what does narration do in a film? It always points out, here, dummy, this is what you're supposed to look
right
at.
Okay, well, I guess I'm putting them all in one big box. I think there's too much narration, you know, most
borderline racist.
Sort of racist.
I'm very touchy on these subjects nowadays.
Nobody wants to see Jews arguing.
Brian, you look like you were trying to get to your microphone.
No, I just, for me, it all comes back to the context of the film. If the film demands you to be in it, you have to be in it. I refuse to believe that there's, you know, a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it, and that it's, you know, a first-time filmmaker thing to put yourself in the film. If the film calls for you to be in it, then if you choose not to be in it, then I think you're really doing a disservice to the audience, and I think you're doing a disservice to the film. Just like if the film demands that you not be in it or doesn't need you in it, to put yourself in it is an equal disservice. So I think you have to really look at each film on an individual basis and say, does this film need this person? And would it work without it? That's how it works for me anyways.
Okay, well, you're more diplomatic than me. I don't agree.
Yeah, who wants to see Jews getting along?
Okay, no more Jewish jokes.
To what extent do you think, there's a disagreement here, it's interesting, because Brian, you're saying that actually these films are more visible now. If they are more visible, it'd be interesting to sort of find out why, and I wonder, is it as simple as the influence of Michael Moore, or is it that damned internet and all that blogging that those kids are up to today?
Well, you know, okay, I had a point about this in your article yesterday, so I think this is a really clear thing. There are people who don't want to be in their film, who don't have the power to say no to producers who tell them, this isn't working, put yourself in it. That there are, I know of a couple of examples of this, and I'm sure other people know more examples of this. It's become such a accepted technique that actually, you know, in my opinion, films are ruined, not by the filmmaker, but by the filmmaker not having the power to say no. And the reason why producers want them to put it in, themselves in it, is there's no downside. Mm-hmm. Nobody's saying that's crap, you shouldn't have been in it. Nobody ever says that. There's no downside, and there's lots of upside to be able to, like, I don't think the audience is getting that, so if you put yourself in it, you will get an opportunity to highlight that part that's not working.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe even the entertainment factor, too. I know we were talking about that, and the fact that the audience can connect with the person,
right.
It's easier for the audience to connect when there's someone leading you along in the film than if you're just telling a story without someone leading you along. You know, they're invested in the film in a way that perhaps they wouldn't be.
And even that, I mean, that's an interesting issue. I mean, because one of the things that, of course, about Moore is that he really brought a certain kind of, I would say, television hosting style to what he did that really kind of, I think, really helped those films work in the way that they did. But that's also an interesting, I mean, it raises a couple of interesting things, because when you appear on screen, how much of it is actually you, and how much of you of it is a performance of you on screen? And if you have, like, you know, you get into some pretty prickly moods over the course of your film, which...
Even here today.
You got to think you get... Well, there you go. Okay, so that was not a performance then. I guess I don't need to ask you that question. But, I mean, I guess my question has to do with the, you know, if broadcasters are perhaps encouraging first-person documentary form because they think it's more entertaining or accessible, does that also create a demand that you have to be nicer people on screen?
I've actually never been in, maybe I'm not listening, but I've never been encouraged to make a personal film. And in fact, Rudy Boutignol, who commissioned this film when he was at TVO, years before was saying, you know, when I was starting out, was saying to me, you know, look, if you want to build up a catalog of films that's going to sell so you can have a career and, you know, survive to a ripe old age, you know, do nature films, basically. I mean, do stuff that you're not in, film fawns, and you know, speak with a British accent, if at all. And, you know, obviously, and this isn't actually, you know, that long ago. I've only made three films, and there really were just a couple of, you know, like Moore and Broomfield who were out there doing it. It seemed like a rare thing, a little slot to aspire towards, but I thought I'd go for it anyway, since I hate fawns. But no, I certainly, so A, I personally have never gotten pressure to make a first personal film, although it seems to be working, so why screw it up? But when you're in them, I don't think there's any pressure to be nicer on screen. I think, you know, drama is conflict, right? I mean, but, you know, if I walked into Pat Buchanan's house at the beginning of the interview and said, you know, you fucking anti-Semite, then I wouldn't have had much of an interview. So you've got to obviously leaven it.
You say it in the car before you get in the house.
Exactly. You know, this
so
is their...
We know you're thinking it.
Many levels of communication with the audience, yeah.
I would like, at this point, to turn the conversation over.
She's had her hand up for like 20 minutes there.
Well, she shouldn't have, because I didn't say put your hands up yet. So I'm going to make her wait for another 20 minutes. If you could just, please, relieve this woman's pain over here with the microphone. And if what we could do is, please wait until the microphone is delivered to you before asking the question, because this is being podcast. That's what the kids like today.
Well, I was just going to say, I think it's true that maybe Jamie's film could have been made without Jamie in it. But, you know, you were talking about how either there's a necessity to be in your film or not. But, Jamie, wouldn't you say that it kind of serves you as a narrative device, kind of providing a thread between things that otherwise might be kind of disconnected? Like in the Django film, you're kind of going from one place to another, and it gives you sort of a momentum to connect things.
Yeah, it's absolutely. It's what Alan said at the beginning. It's something to, some, at the very least, something to cut away to. And insofar as it's an essay film, it's that's where you get the essay part in. Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, my next film, I think, what will be my next film? I could be in it. Right. You.
I think I should do a movie about you two. You can both be in.
Yeah, we should take this show on the road. Anyway, yeah, I could, like, I'm a little worried about, I mean, there's no reason for me to be in it, but I could be in it. And it would make it easier. It would make it easier.
I think you're going to be in it.
No.
Definitely.
No. No, but, and the other problem is, like, I've pitched films that there's absolutely no reason for me to be in, and then had people go, I hope you're not going to be in it. And it's like, anyway, yeah.
So then you put yourself in just to spite them.
Sir?
I really enjoy... The first-person presence in films, and I've enjoyed McElwee and Bloomfield, as you have yourself, and I don't think, I find no objection to it at all. I'm Jamie Castner's uncle Peter, and having been an actor, I've starred in Francis Coppola's first feature film, and but now I'm interested in making
video.
Someone
turn a camera on this man.
Absolutely. But now I'm interested in making video, and the issue of the and I find that that I'm entering into the things I make specifically, and the question comes real soon, but specifically I'm initiating a documentary series at the Brunswick Theater every Thursday starting May 17 with a documentary called Let's Meet the Castners. It's about my family, my siblings, and to some extent about Jamie. And the issue of my appearing in that is a real question for me. And the other sort of venue I'm experimenting with, because I'm not on the radar screen of commercial television, is YouTube. I'm actually starting to post, probably tonight or tomorrow night, a history of my family in Toronto called the Castner Chronicles, and the first chapters of it are really about Jamie.
First personal filmmaking can also help your estranged relatives.
There you go.
It's not only
and
me.
I'm calling
everybody will show up, make a film, and maybe this will happen to you.
I'm calling the first chapters.
I don't know if you remember me, but I was a driver on Unfinished Business.
I do. But I'm calling the first chapters of the YouTube event Kike Like My Nephew Jamie, and it's about Jamie and Jamie's history. And my own appearance in that is an issue for me. So my question... So
my appearance in it is an issue, too. You should
call
my lawyer.
My question to the panelists, to the extent that I'm permitted to ask it, is do you have a sense in your own work as documentarians of the way that your presence, your sort of performance presence, not in a negative way, but shifts the endeavor away from something that we might traditionally understand as being documentary towards something that is more like performance? This is not a negative process. But did you have a sense of that process, and can you speculate about
that?
Yes.
Thank you. Anything to add on the... performance? Does it compromise the idea of
my sympathy for Jamie just went way up.
The only thing I would say to you is, who cares? Not about your film, but who cares? Put it out there. If people like it, they'll watch it. Not to sound like capitalist about this, but I mean, like, why be so rigid about what a documentary is, what it isn't? Make the thing. If it's a documentary, if it's a fiction, who cares? Make something that people are interested in.
Okay. Your question down here.
I'd like to historicize this discussion, because in fact the whole idea of a personal documentary arose precisely because documentary had notions of objectivity attached to it, and I mean, and ethnographic, and the certain kind of eye of looking at people, and the personal film came out of wanting the filmmaker to be subjective and put himself or herself in the picture. And it seems to me now that we're at a different moment. I mean, I'm not sure whether I like it or not. I'm guilty of it, but where it seems the personal kind of filmmaking is getting fetishized, it's becoming one more technique. And I'm wondering how you would respond to that. But, you know, I'm really mindful of, while we're having a good time listening to you guys, that it arose out of a real crisis in documentary, and which arose out of, a political moment, or of a series of political moments. So I'm wondering how you would respond to that.
Could I ask you, before I turn it over, sort of, if you could, what would you say that moment was?
Decolonization, precisely. Decolonization.
Right.
I mean, more than anything else, I would say. Where people said, hang on a second, this is not who we are. And we're tired of you telling us who we are through the films that you make. So I think sensitive people turned around, perhaps, and said, okay, let me make films about subjects I know. Mm-hmm. And you went closer and closer to home, and then finally, perhaps, you turned around yourself. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering now, with this whole other world that we are living in, of everybody being performers all the time, whether it's on YouTube or MySpace or... and the whole ritualistic kind of exposure of self that we constantly do, mm-hmm. particularly, and we seem to be so media saturated, whether we're in a different moment, and whether, I mean, I can go on. But anyway, I'm just curious about your response.
I think I already answered that. I mean, yeah, I do think it's. I mean, again, I mean, I'd like to be as diplomatic as Brian, but again, I think it's become a genre unto itself, and yeah, it produced some good films, but it produced a lot of films that people shouldn't have been in. That's all. I'm just not sure how much people who are making films are thinking about anything, like anything that they're doing. I mean, the thing about documentary is that I've said hyperbolically that there's more film technique in your average porn film than in a documentary. But my point is that documentary filmmakers, I think, are more, feel more, what's the word, enclosed by convention than anybody else, like B-roll, like can we dispense with the shot of the guy walking through the frame that we cut away to the, like, just like, everybody knows 5 seconds before that he was standing there, and then they just said, walk the camera, but don't look in the lens. Like, I hate that shot, right? So I think the same thing is true with the first person. I think it's just become another convention.
It's interesting because, of course, what you're talking about is something which is you're suggesting comes out of the shift to subjectivity was extremely crucial, extremely important, made a political statement. Now it mostly just seems to be about me and getting me on screen. Yeah, yeah. And I would say, I don't know if anybody here saw the movie about the guy trying to get the date with Drew Barrymore a couple of years ago. Yeah, I was ready to actually see if I could pass a law against first-person documentary after seeing that movie. That was it. Over here, please.
The strength of first-person documentaries are still that there's a story being told. And I've only
could
seen...
Could you, sorry, speak into the mic, sir.
Oh, am I not speaking to the mic here? I still think it's interesting that it's always a story being told. There's always a moment, a journey to, you know, that old word. I've only seen Brian's film, but I wondered it for all of you, about the structure when you... there's always a moment, there's a desire you want to get somewhere at the end of your film. You have moments, there's epiphany. Like in Brian's film, I remember there's the two conversations, the one he had with his dad and the one he had with his mother, I felt were really interesting devices about changing where the film was going or making realizations. And I just wondered if all of you, when you're going through the process, you're filming, you're all obviously directing this, I mean, when do you step back and start to look at the story? In the editing phase, or are you looking at it after every day, or are you talking to your producer? I mean, what's the process, the structural process? Because really, we still can't have just me the whole way through. There is a reason for it, I think.
Well, I think even if you're a character in your film, you're still dealing with the same kind of dramatic structural challenges as with any film. So the only difference is that now you're a character, so you know you either want to work with or against, I suppose, narrative traditions of having a story arc and seeing your character develop. And the only other added challenge, I guess, is that you have to step back from that and try to look at yourself somewhat objectively as a character in order to do that.
The way I treated it was like, if I was going to make a movie about a father and his son, and the son wasn't me, would the son have been in the movie? Would the scenes of the son talking to the father have been in the movie, the scenes of the mother? Of course, right? That's where the drama was. So the fact that it was me just... you know, when I took a step back and put on my director's hat, it was like, of course you're going to put those in. And where you're going to put them in is where they're going to have the most dramatic effect. So, yeah, I was in the film. But when I was directing and when we were editing, I wasn't looking at me. I was looking at the guy's son and what needed to happen to the guy's son in order to make the story work.
And I think for me, I sort of figure it all out in the edit suite. So after I have all the footage, I look at it all and decide how am I going to put this all together. And it became a complex structure. And I kept thinking, okay, I still want to talk about the biography, but I also want to do this parallel story of me trying to talk to Michael and how that's influencing the biography as well. And so I just had to sort of figure out where I was going to put in one story and fit it into the other story so that it would work and try not to be too confusing for the audience.
Well, you know, I'm aware of the fact that films are about a character changing. That's what people want. And I'm particularly aware of the fact that journalists, when you finish your film, will always ask you, what did you learn? How did you change? So I prepare answers for that question, but I don't do it in, like, it would be disingenuous in the films I've made for me to have changed that much. So it's, I mean, yeah, that's all I can say, really. So I try to end it, the films, with giving the sense that I learned something, because I think that helps. But I don't try to give the impression that I learned too much until I get interviewed, and then I learned a hell of a lot.
Over here, please.
Actually, I had a really similar question about structure, because it is all about storytelling. And so you've answered basically my question, but I'm interested in Debbie's film. So I'm interested in the film where there's two crises, maybe the personal storytelling crises and then the crisis of what is actually happening in that film, and how you muddle through that and work that out as the first person narrator and also as the filmmaker.
The stories are sort of, in Manufacturing Descent, the stories of Michael's biography and my story are sort of going along parallel, and they converge at one point, and then they sort of become one. What else? I don't know, what else do you want me to say? Yeah, and so then at the end it sort of becomes the same after the convergence. Sure.
The question was concerning the settling on the specific resolutions that they did in their film, as opposed to other ways that they might have ended them.
I was pretty well locked in by the material that I had. I hadn't actually intended on, my film ends shortly after a visit to Auschwitz, and I hadn't actually intended on ending there, and I wasn't even really happy with the things I said on camera there, but I could see, you know, objectively as the director, that this was the emotional climax, the character's emotional climax. I tried actually a whole bunch of endings, and basically, you know, after that, the show's over. So, no, I didn't have a lot of options in this case.
I was lucky in that I had sort of this competition to act as a structuring device, so it sort of set, like, I knew it was going to end shortly after the competition end. So the tone, I didn't know. Obviously, it would depend on how, you know, my relationship with my father had developed over the course of filming, etc. But as far as, like, structurally how it could end, I knew there was going to be finality of the competition, he would either win or not win, and then we would deal with the aftermath. So it was kind of pretty formulaic in that way, I guess.
But you didn't toy with using voiceover that said, you know, after all this, I actually still don't like my dad.
If I had felt that way, I would have said it. Right. Yeah. I mean, I honestly think that.
Mm-hmm. We have a hand up over here, please.
My question is for Brian. To what extent was your father a presence in the editing room and your idea of him as being an audience person?
That's the second part.
To what extent were you worried about him judging your film as your father being in the audience?
Well, in answer to the first question, he had no say on the editing process whatsoever. We made it very clear from the very before we started rolling cameras that I would have to have carte blanche. So he had. He didn't know anything about it or see anything about it until the picture was locked and the film was done. He saw the film, obviously, before I screened it for anyone else. Of course I was worried. But I felt confident that he would see the value in it after he got over some specific things. And I think that's how it worked out. So it could have been a royal disaster, absolutely. But, you know, I crossed my fingers and hoped for the best. And you know, I'm happy with the result.
I'm curious, did you ever say, maybe I shouldn't put that in because, you know, he's going to see it, and maybe I should just, you know, lighten this part up a bit or something?
Yeah, definitely. But
and then
you know
those were the parts you put in.
And as soon as you ask that question, you know the answer.
Right, but you worry about what your parents will think whether they're in your film or not.
Of course. You know.
Whether they're alive or not, you wonder that.
I mean, my mother passed away a couple years ago, and that's actually in the film. But anyway, my first thought was, now I can do porn.
We had a question down here in the second row, please.
So you've all expressed to some extent an awareness of this convention of the first-person narrator. To what extent did any of you ever fall prey to the temptation of performance rather than a truthful exploration of your ideas?
Depends how much money was involved.
Okay. Are you serious?
Well, I suppose to a certain extent, you know, if someone offered you a job hosting something that's clearly performative, they like, you know, your performance in the thing, you know, something like that.
Okay, so do you find yourself...
But no, I don't, in my actual films, I think the challenge is the material is always stronger the less phony it appears, so, yeah.
I think in the larger sense.
Conscious of it. You know, you're conscious of it. Look, I would fake it if it looked right. I would. I tried. You know, it looked like crap. It looked phony. And ultimately, you're guided by the reality of what you got on screen. Mm-hmm. So I think that wins out as opposed to any great ethics.
Yeah, I think that in whatever you have, it is a performance. Absolutely. I mean, that doesn't mean it's, you know, the worst kind of performance or that you're hamming it up. But I mean, you know, I do my parts alone in my house and I'm talking to myself. That's not easy, actually, you know? I mean, I know I got a big mouth, but when there's nobody there, it's not, mm-hmm. you know, it's not that natural. I have to put myself in the mood and I have to work up to it. And that is a performance, you know, but I try to cut out, if I see something where I think I was being, you know, whatever, phony, I try to cut it out. But no, when the camera's on you, that's a performance. This is a performance. I mean, anything unnatural like this, that's a performance, I think.
I think for me, the one scene when we get kicked out of Kent State, I realized at the moment, first of all, I was shocked that it was happening, but at the same time, I had to realize, oh my God, I should be saying something about this because I should sort of put a point on the fact of what's happening. And I kept thinking, should I say something? Should I? And then I just sort of mumbled something about, you know, oh great, Michael's for freedom of speech and we're being kicked out of a Michael Moore speech, you know, and because then he's banning us for freedom of speech. So I felt like I should say something. And so I said that at the time. And then the other time when he hugged me, very much aware that the camera's there. And again, you know, it was very awkward. He grabs me to hug me, and I'm thinking, oh, great, this is very awkward. It's manipulative. He knows there's a camera there. I know there's a camera there, so I can't just push him away because then I look like a jerk, you know. But at the same time, I don't really want to hug the guy. But then I hug him anyway. So it was a very awkward moment, I felt.
I think anytime you do a documentary, the people that you put in front of the camera are going to be performing at the start. And the key to being a documentary director is getting to them to the point where they've stopped performing and started being real. And I don't think as a first person you're any different. So you're going to feel that immediacy at first, and you're going to be very aware of the camera. But then you have to sort of do that director thing and make whatever changes you have to make to get comfortable with the camera, and then it just disappears into the background and you stop performing and you become yourself. I mean, for my interview with my mother and father, I can tell you I had no idea. By the end of those interviews, I didn't know there was a camera there.
Actually, I think this touches on one of the fallacies of this whole debate, the personal versus non-personal thing, which is that every time you turn, I would disagree with, or I mean, I know you're speaking broadly, but you know, you wait for them to stop performing and start becoming real. I would say that any time you have a camera on someone, it is a performance, and what you're really saying is you're waiting for the performance to get better. And I think that actually the argument could be made that first personal filmmaking can be an acknowledgement of the fallacy of the whole form. And you're saying, I'm not pretending I'm some objective, voice of God, and we're just chronicling something that's really happening. I walked up this guy's house with a camera. His maid got a little shy. You know, we fought. He kicked me out, you know, and that's the story. That's more honest, perhaps.
But I think it also speaks to the difference in the form that you were taking and sort of the genre, because I do think that just because they're first-person films doesn't mean they fit into the same genre box. And I think, so I absolutely agree. I think that's a really great point, so I'm not disagreeing. But I think you have to look at the first-person documentary form and then put it into its subcategories, and there's going to be maybe different modes and different avenues per subcategory.
Yeah, sure.
I think, you know, the thing about, you know, all documentary practice, no matter from which perspective you're approaching it, cameras aren't natural, even though they're more ubiquitous now than ever. They still aren't natural. What they do is they create a reaction, right? And the moment you introduce something that creates a reaction, then the naturalism you're looking for is gone by definition, right? It's gone. So the strategies to either create an impression of that naturalism, or I think to try and bring down the level, you know, work through the medium that you have introduced, becomes part of one of those interesting questions of documentary practice. I remember something that, you know, the filmmaker John Sayles said in a piece that he wrote many years ago about Barbara Kopple's film, Harlan County, USA. I don't know if you've seen it. But he said the remarkable thing about that movie is that you can tell that she spent the porch time with the people before she shot anything, right? So, which meant that she knew when she was going into the Appalachians and she was about to make a film about this mining strike that these were people who were not accustomed to having crews of hip New York filmmakers around them making movies. So, but before cameras ever ran, you know, she spent a long time with them so that they were at least more comfortable, you know. So I think all of this becomes basically questions of, you know, sort of degree, you know. Yes, I'm sorry.
It's a really interesting debate, but the whole debate so far, we've not talked about this first person. Who is this first person? The sort of, you know, all of the whole debate is taking place in a sort of context which completely ignores sort of all the debates about the nature of self itself over the last 50 years. And I kind of wonder whether what the panel thinks about the idea that perhaps both the kind of increase in the production of first person or autobiographical films in whatever way, and also the appetite for their consumption by the audience, has got something to do with the fact that we're desperate to try and work out who we are.
I just think that's a great point.
I think it's definitely, you know, a lot more analytical society, self-analysis, all of that, and it's more popular. And yeah, I think perhaps people in the audience, when people are doing first-person narrative about themselves, other people find something that they're touched by in that film.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if my answer is to your question, but the influences that made me or allowed me to put myself in my film were from literature, where Harvey Pekar had a big influence, Bukowski. I always liked literature that was thinly veiled autobiography. I always liked, you know, first person stuff. I always liked what people sometimes call creative nonfiction. But I mean, Harvey Pekar, American Splendor comics, the fact that he told such small stories about such small things, the idea that I heard somebody once say, the more thoroughly personal, the more universal it is, those were the things that made me feel sort of I could get away with being in my film. And also that in a film about collecting records, I could talk about having mice in my house. That's so.
Three hands clustered right there.
This question is to Brian, and I'm curious because I know from personal experience how difficult it can be to film complicated familial stuff. And I'm really curious to know how you went about proposing this project to your father and got sort of him on board and his support for it before he even knew how he'd be represented.
Well, I think it helps that he's a bodybuilder and likes to strip down to his bikini shorts and pose in front of people. But I also think he genuinely wanted to fix things and had no idea how to do it. And so he sort of said, okay, if you're going to take the lead, I'll follow. So that would be my real answer. But maybe it has more to do with just wanting to see himself on screen. But I don't really believe that.
Just pass the mic. Over the row there.
Just going back to the point we were discussing before this question, which was about making a film that's really personal and yet universal, to what degree or where, how do you decide when a film has become too self-indulgent to be universal? I mean, the fact that you're here with showing your films in a festival means that you want to share your work, so it's not entirely just for yourself. So where do you find that line? How do you decide the degree to which you involve yourself and the degree to which you want a message?
That sort of gets back to my question to you, Brian, earlier about why should we care about your feelings about your dad, and at a certain point, you know, so at what point does your personal experience become something that you can safely assume will be of interest to an audience?
I'm not sure you should care about my relationship with my father. I really don't think you should. The question is whether you do. And if you do, you'll like the film. And if you don't, you won't like the film, or you won't go to see it. So the question for me is not whether you should care or why should you care. The question is whether you do or not. And that's a question for the audience. It's not a question for the filmmaker.
Well, I think I can answer this question a bit anyway, maybe. Like, I've been praised mostly for being really honest in my films. And I often think I could be a lot more honest. You know, there's stuff I'm not telling you, and so actually in this film I did record things that would prove how honest I am, but I didn't even check them when I was logging because I didn't even want my editor to see them, and because I realized if I put them in, you would go, wow, I can't believe he said that, but that would be basically all you would get out of it. So, that's a real question for me. What's too much, you know? I mean, in my first film, I killed my dog. And this last film, my mother dies, and I really wondered if I
should... Your dog. I saw the movie. He didn't really kill his dog.
Anyway, what the point is...
Dog did die.
The fact is that dogs were harmed in the making of the film. And
the dog who was alive at the beginning, who was deceased.
And you know what? The thing is, that is the one thing in the film that I wish I could cut out. Because I didn't know much about how the form worked. And I thought I needed to put that in to sort of say to you, I'm going to be talking about other things here. But now when I see the film, I wish that was out. So I think you should be as personal as you can with, like, as part of your story, but not so personal that people will go, wow, I can't believe he said that. Although I do see films where people do that, and it is amazing, you know? I mean, there's a film, I don't know if you've seen, about spam, and the guy tries the weight loss thing, and he, like, strips down to his clothes and puts the cream on and puts the suit on, all on camera. There's not enough money in the world that would get me to do that. But, you know, and I was kind of like, I can't believe the director is doing this. So I thought that was, yeah.
Yeah, I think basically you have to use the same powers of discrimination that you would try to exercise in the edit suite in any case. And you've hopefully got a really good editor that you trust who can bring some objectivity to bear. But that was a lot more boring than what you just said. So.
Another question. Same neighborhood.
Hi. I spend a lot of time thinking about who is telling whose story, for whom, using whose storytelling methods, and why. And I think about that with relation to some of the key things in our society, race, class, gender, etc., and how your own personal experiences and the way you've experienced the world and the biases inherent in your place in society are going to very much shape the story you're telling and who you're telling it for, and whether it's for the dominant and the mainstream or underrepresented groups and so on. When I think about first-person documentaries, I think finally we're getting to see whose lens we're seeing the world through. And I'm wondering if you've thought about that aspect of first-person documentary filmmaking in terms of the lens and the biases that every single person will have based on where they're coming from and how that affects the story that you're telling.
You know, the funny thing about that question is, you know, there's an answer I could say that's bullshit. Or, like, I made a film about record collectors. People say, it's good that you're not laughing at your subjects because you're implicating yourself in the story because you're a record collector too. And I sort of pat myself on the back for that. But I'm quite aware of the fact that when there are moments in the film when people are laughing at the guy, that's just me as a director letting you laugh at the guy. And because the director, no matter how much you're implicated in your film, you are also in a privileged position. People know you made the film. So it's all like, no matter how much you make a fool of yourself, people are still kind of thinking you're hot shit because you made the film. So I think it's really hard to implicate yourself in the story, no matter how much you might try. Really, you are kind of king in your own film, no matter how much you might try to sort of, you know, be with the peons in the rest of the film. It's a problem, it is.
Anyone else want to touch that? Or are you gonna leave it with the king?
It's a little too postmodernist for my, it's just too much of an intellectual pursuit, I think. For me, it had much more to do with the emotional take on the story. I didn't really give that much thought to that sort of theoretical realm, sorry.
There's no coming after Alan. This is what it's taken me an hour and a half to learn.
Okay, well then, one more question. This will be our last question.
Hello, I think it's great that you guys are so diverse and you guys come from such different backgrounds. I was just wondering what your next step is.
We all grew up in Forest Hill, but besides that.
I'm just wondering, like, after you've finished a project in first person like this, do you plan to do another first person documentary? Just like, it's, some of you have answered this, and I know that it's something that you will continue to pursue, but I'm just wondering if it's a question open to all of you guys.
I'm talking before Alan.
No.
I having set out to make a film about a subject that was of true personal interest to me, I found it got a lot more personal than I anticipated. And now, whereas previously I might have said, oh, I can do some funny bits and be in a film about just about anything before, I now actually, that doesn't seem so simple to me anymore. Like, I kind of flip out at the last section of my film. It's really fun. What other topic am I going to flip out like that about? I can keep reenacting that every film. So I don't know. Good question.
I hope I won't be doing another one. But I suppose we should never say never, because then people will be here going, "Hey, you said you'd never do it again." So yeah, hopefully not.
I certainly hope not.
Well, you're going to law school. You've got an out from all this, right?
Please join me in thanking my panelists today. Brian Friedman, Debbie Melnick, Alan Zweig, Jamie Castor. Thanks for coming.